Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends to doctors in women's health.
Sotiria, we talked about, you know, specifically the importance of the patient-doctor collaboration when it comes to addressing uterine fibroids. Let us know why that is so important, especially from your perspective as someone who has struggled with uterine fibroids and who has worked so hard to find the best avenues for effective treatment, not just for yourself, but for so many other women through the Fibroid Foundation.
Well, thank you for that question, Angie. And it's such a pleasure to be able to highlight an area that is so incredibly important. And really for me, I started advocating, it was a fact-finding mission, you know, to try to find the right provider. And over time, the power of the patient voice has become so incredibly important, even more so than when I initially started on this journey. I remember going into a meeting for the Compare UF research study, and it was me and 16 physicians in the room. And we had worked over a year to win that grant and start that research study. And I immediately felt apprehensive and kind of intimidated with me, a patient, being in a room with 16 physicians. And I decided that I had to find the voice to help the millions of women affected by this. And what that experience taught me over that experience and many subsequent experiences taught me the power of the patient voice, and that every woman is an expert in her body. She can tell a clinician very important details, very specific details to help inform their treatment plan. So the way I view the physician-patient interaction is really a collaboration of experts. The patient is the expert in her body. The physician is the expert in their area of expertise. And when you merge the two, you optimally will be able to develop a treatment plan that is just really beautifully tailored to the needs of that individual. And the outcomes increase from that interaction, and the overall experience increases. There have been some feedback that I've been able to provide from my patient experience that has even really blown me away. I'll give you one example. Again, with the COMPARE study, we did an AMH study, and I asked what size vials they were going to use for the blood draws, and they kind of wondered why. That's an odd question. And I said, because most women who are severely anemic who seek treatment for fibroids feel really badly when they're at the doctor's office. So if three or four vials of blood are drawn, they may leave the appointment feeling far worse than they did when they arrived. So as a result of that feedback, and because that was a personal experience of mine, the vial size for the AMH blood draws were reduced to the smallest vial that could possibly be used for that particular study. And I consider that a huge win. And that is an example of a patient experience that only a patient could provide to be able to inform a research study or other processes to enhance the overall experience of patients when they're seeking treatment.
Dr. Alhindi, would you like to add to that at all?
I think Sotiria very eloquently presented this. I think the interaction between the physician and the patient and the dialogue is the most important to get a good outcome and also a satisfactory outcome. Because, a good outcome from the doctor's side, sometimes if the relationship is not, balanced and well kind of developed, could mean a different thing for the patient. The doctors that can do a surgery, a fancy surgery, no complication, no side effects and so on. And that's a good outcome from the surgeon side or the physician side. But the patient might not have wanted to have a hysterectomy in the first place. and so on. And she's medically okay, but she might not be satisfied. So I really can't emphasize enough what Sateria said. To me, I always feel my job is I'm information provider, and then I'm a technician. I provide the information, the different options. Of course, I work with the patient to diagnose the disease. Now we're talking about fibroids, so we already have a diagnosis, and then provide the different treatment options, and then be the technician who perform the option that the patient wanted. Not more than that. And honestly, I think this is, I would say it's almost even easier also for the physician. I've seen physicians who, in my experience, my colleagues, and even as some of my trainees and fellows, who try to interfere in the decision process and even make decisions for the patient. I think that's totally unnecessary, and actually it totally kind of override the process. And I don't think it leads to a satisfied patient health consumer, if you want to call it that way. So I think it's for the sake of both the patient outcome, which is the most important, and also for the physician. The patient need to make all the decisions, but after physicians provide appropriate information, and then whatever the decision the patient makes, then we are, especially if there's some procedure involved and surgery and so on, we would be the technician who perform that decision. That's how I look at the process.
I completely agree. And that is, what Ayman just described is the compassionate care that's so needed. And most of the physicians that we refer our community to do have that level of compassion, because the patient can sense that. And the overall interaction between patient and physician is so much better when there is an environment where the patient feels comfortable speaking with their care provider.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the prevalence of uterine fibroids, because we know that 1 in 3 women struggles with uterine fibroids. How have treatments progressed, and what are some of the most effective methods for preserving fertility?
Okay, is this for Sateria or for me?
Start with you, Dr. Elhendy. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I think Sateria knows a lot about this as well. Yes, it's a highly prevalent disease, as you mentioned. In autopsy studies, 77% of women have actual uterine fibroids. Luckily, a good number of those never develop symptoms. The number usually hover around 50%. So you actually can have fibroid, let's say we see it on ultrasound, but you don't develop symptoms. But 50% do develop symptoms, and that needs medical attention. That's still a lot of patients. At any point of time, the numbers that being used in the U.S., there's about 30 million women suffering from uterine fibroids seeking medical help. There's probably a lot more who are suffering in silence, and they are not seeking medical help. And we can talk more about those if you want. But as far as how the treatment paradigm changed over time, I'm happy to see actually the recent development. For a long time, there hasn't been new intervention or new development in the treatment options for uterine fibroid. And for a long time, fibroid equaled surgery, okay? And still up to this point, surgery is used quite extensively, I would say, for treatment of fibroid, either in the form of hysterectomy or myomectomy. And of course, for our audience, they know what these surgeries mean.
Yes.
We do in the U.S. About 600,000 hysterectomies every year. Most of those are for patients with uterine fibroids, and we do about 35,000 myomectomies every year. Just to give you kind of a perspective, we are the number one country in the developed world as far as number of hysterectomies per population. We do about 5.2 hysterectomies per 1,000 women. Canada, they do about 1.2. hysterectomies per 1,000 patients, so about 1/5. And then in Europe, Germany is the highest number of hysterectomies in Europe. They do about 3 hysterectomies per 1,000, so about half of what we do in the U.S. So we are by far doing too many hysterectomies compared to other developed countries. So Now, in the last 15, 20 years, there has been some new development. It's still in a procedure form, but at least it's less invasive or non-invasive in the form of uterine artery embolization and also focused MRI-guided focused ultrasound. These are good procedures for select patients. However, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology recommendation, the ACOG recommendation, still is not to perform these procedures in women who are pursuing future pregnancy. So if my patient sitting in the office and tells me that, yes, I am planning to have future pregnancy, I haven't completed my family yet or haven't even started my family, I would not offer her uterine artery embolization or focus ultrasound. That's different from some of the literature out there that showed that women got pregnant after these procedures. That's different because there's no denominator in those studies. Like, for example, we can do uterine artery embolization and the patient decide on her own to go and get pregnant. That's different from intentionally or doing a study comparing those who have embolization and going to go ahead and get pregnant and compare them to those who did not have the procedure. When we did those appropriately designed studies, those who had embolization and then went on to get pregnant, they had more complicated pregnancy. Things like increased risk of miscarriage, increased risk of abnormal placentation like placenta previa, placenta accreta, et cetera, and also preterm labor. So still the ACOG recommendation not to offer this procedure for a patient who wants to go ahead and get pregnant in the future. So, and then the new development in the field in the last few years was medical therapy, typically in the form of an oral medication. And about a year ago now, last May, we got the first FDA-approved oral medication for long-term treatment of uterine fibroids. The chemical name is elagolix with estrogen and progesterone, and the commercial name is Orion. So this is very exciting. And this is from a family of compounds that's called oral GnRH antagonists. So the way this group of medication works is by causing a temporary shutdown of the ovary, okay? Because the hormones that come from the ovary is really the estrogen and progesterone is how fibroids thrive and grow. So when we deprive the fibroid from these hormones, they struggle and they start to shrink and die off. And of course, the symptoms also start to get better. So Orion or elagolix and ADVAC therapy was the first member of that family. It's already FDA approved. There are two other members that's being evaluated now. Urologolix with ADVAC therapy or called urologolix combination therapy. The expectation that that might get approved this summer. And then linzagolix with ADVAC therapy hopefully might be approved in 2022. So with all of these new FDA approved medications, I think there will be a wide spectrum of options and more non-surgical option for patient with fibroid. Just want to emphasize, because you were asking about the fertility question. Yes. At the moment, if somebody is planning to having fibroid and the clinical scenario suggests that the fibroids is the reason why she can't get pregnant, because the association between fibroid and infertility or inability to get pregnant is really an association. If you have infertility and everything else is fine, your tubes are fine, there's a good sperm count in your partner, etc. And the only thing we can find that seems to be abnormal is the fact that you have uterine fibroid. That's still called unexplained infertility associated with uterine fibroid. Because there's also a lot of women with fibroid who gets pregnant. So it's really an association. But if that's the case, the main treatment at the moment, if you are planning to get pregnant right away, is still myomectomy, right? Yes. However, yes. In the general strategy, in a young person who wants to consider future fertility and she has fibroid, then we can definitely explore those non-surgical options, medical treatment options to treat her fibroid symptoms while preserving her future fertility potential.
Sotiria, would you like to add anything to what Dr. Elhendy has said?
Sure, that was a really comprehensive answer, and I'm always reminded of so many important data points when I hear Dr. Elhendy speak. I just wanted to point out that another medical therapy, tranexamic acid, is very important, and the key to women being able to maintain their fertility mm-hmm. is them being comfortable, not being in agony, and being availed of all treatment options to help them to preserve their fertility. And I also always like to point out that there are many, many women who have the desire to keep their uterus regardless of fertility goals. I happen to be one of those people. And, you know, it's so important to emphasize that point as well. Medical therapies can help with sleep because there's often sleep deprivation with heavy menstrual bleeding and other symptomatic fibroid issues. They can help you with your work experience, with travel. I've been on planes where I couldn't get up and use a restroom, flying across the country, and you know, experienced a gush and just was very anemic and very sick. And you know, there are more treatment options now that can assist with those experiences. Vacation to allow to enhance that quality of life. All of these things help women be able to, they're tools for them to be able to keep their uterus and potential future fertility goals in place. And I think that those are critical to be able to just, for our medical community to thoroughly educate themselves on all of these tools and the tools that are evolving so that then they can share them with their patients.
Now, you were pretty young when you were diagnosed originally.
I was very young and yeah. immediately told to have a hysterectomy, like there was no other option. And fortunately, I sought out another option. And then there were many, many layers of issues with finding the right provider. So I'm pleased to see that we are moving in the right direction, I think, in terms of treatments and treatment options. And but you'd be surprised at how many people still are not aware of the treatments that exist. And, you know, the medical community can help us with that, to help everyone maintain a good quality of life and to have the outcomes that they desire. That really is pivotal for you to have a conversation with your patients about what their goals are for treatment and then start from there and work forward.
Right. And Angie, if I can, I just 100% agree with Sotiria, and I want to emphasize that. And again, hysterectomy or myomectomy are great options in select patients. So I'm not bashing surgical intervention. I'm a surgeon. You actually got me in my scraps today. But I think we should take the physician and patient, and back to your first question about the importance of this dialogue, it should be a dialogue, not a monologue. We shouldn't take that decision to make surgery lightly, because there's increasing literature now and evidence that about the long-term negative effects of hysterectomy. The group in Mayo really pioneers in this, but others, and we actually published a review article on this recently, and others are contributing to this area. We're all aware of the short-term, possible short-term complications of hysterectomy, and that's actually what most of surgeons spend the time in the office counseling the patient about. What can happen right in the OR or the few days, the infection, bleeding, etc. But there's less and less discussion on the long-term effect. And even there, we have been aware for many years about the pelvic floor disorders. After a total hysterectomy, there's increased risk of urinary incontinence, increased risk of what they call vault prolapse, the top part of the vagina that we suture together, coming down and falling down. Even that was, we were aware of this for many years, but they don't get discussed a lot during the session when you consent the patient for hysterectomy. But now we actually know about other long-term negative effects about the heart disease, women who had hysterectomy, even if we preserve the ovaries, they are at increased risk statistically for heart disease, for dementia, for cognitive disorders, etc. So all of this really suggests that the counseling session for hysterectomy should be a detailed one, and we should cover short-term but also long-term consequences so that the patient can make the most informed, the most suitable decision for herself.
Yes, absolutely. So going into my next question, and Sotiria and I talked about this a little bit, I don't know if you were on the call yet, Dr. Alhendy, about uterine fibroids disproportionately affecting women of color, and that this population, and you know all of this, but to get it on the record here, that this population is diagnosed with fibroids about 3 times more than white women. So I would like to know from each of you, Sotiria, what have you found in your experience that might help us understand why this is the case? And then I have Dr. Alhendy also.
Sure. Well, the high diagnosis rates, we really don't know why fibroids occur to a higher severity level in women of African descent. We do know that women of African descent have higher estrogen levels, but that's about all we know. And Dr. Alhendy is the expert in this, and he can, you know, definitely clarify. But I think that the diagnosis rates are higher for that reason. We're still trying to uncover why fibroids develop in the body and why white women could have more fibroids in terms of number, but much lower in symptoms. And you know, like me, I had 3 symptomatic fibroids for most of my life, I had a 2-centimeter pedunculated fibroid that almost had me lose over half my blood supply. You know, there are things like that that really cause you to wonder what role genetics is playing in how the body is responding in terms of developing uterine fibroids. And beyond that, we have not yet uncovered, but one of our goals is to really try to support research that's going to help us to thoroughly explore the dynamics behind the development of this health concern.
Dr. Alhendy, what would you like to add to that?
Right. So, no, I totally agree with Sotiria. We don't have a full understanding. Definitely, we need more research on this. And I'm hoping, and there's potentially good news, that there will be hopefully more NIH support for fibroid research in the next few years. So I think that will help a lot. But I want to touch on something quickly that Sotiria mentioned, and then I'll come back to the health disparity issue. About what Sotiria very nicely presented, actually, is that we don't have a good classification for fibroid. She said she had a small fibroid with a lot of symptoms. And that right away tells you that the current classification we have, which is based on the location of fibroid and the size of fibroid, doesn't really correlate well with symptoms. Okay. So as she said, you can have a small fibroid, but and it's a certain location and have lots of symptoms. Another patient might have a much larger fibroid, but it's in a different location. They're really and have very minimal symptoms. So there's really poor correlation. The good news that there are some work in this area by our group and a group in Ottawa and University of Ottawa and others about actually trying to understand this better and maybe actually look at the relation between the consistency of the fibroid, how stiff they are, the stiffness of the fibroid and the symptoms. And the preliminary assessment suggests that that might be a better marker for the symptoms because it's actually a reflect of the biology. It turns out that stiff fibroid, like hard fibroid and firm fibroid, have more aggressive biology than the soft ones. So it adds another element which correlates well with the biology, which then hopefully correlate better with the symptoms. So I just wanted to touch on that. But back to the health, it's really exciting. And we can measure the fibroid stiffness simply by a simple, a special kind of ultrasound. It's called elastography, shear wave elastography, SWE. So it's just like done the same way like the regular ultrasound, but needs an extra piece of technology. Uh-huh. So I think this will be a major addition to the field to serve our patient better. But back to the question about the health disparity, absolutely, it's a major challenge. Mm-hmm. We have gained some, I would say, a little better understanding of it, but certainly, as Satoria said, we still have a long way to go and we need a lot more research in this area. One of the things, so we actually kind of developed a model that is going to be published soon in Endocrine Review that I can summarize it as the two-hit model or two-hit theory. It seems like a common theme how fibroids start by early life adverse environmental exposure. So when there's a female fetus, even so early when the fetus still in her mother's womb, if there was unfortunate adverse environmental exposure to bad environmental pollution, especially certain ones that works as an estrogen, things like phthalate that's found in plastics and so on. Of course, the DS story is very famous. BSA, I mean, there are many environmental factors that mimic estrogen.
Yes.
And if the female fetus gets exposed to this very early in her life while she's in the womb, that's the sensitive period when the uterus is being developed, her cells, her myometrium, her uterine wall become sensitized or primed in a way to develop fibroid later. So that's the first hit. Now you need a second hit. Not everybody who will be exposed to this will develop fibroid. Otherwise, probably 100% of women will develop fibroid because environmental pollution, unfortunately, is very common. But you need that second hit. And that second hit could be many, many things. One of the things we worked on is vitamin D deficiency. We have published extensively on that, and others have confirmed this all around the world. And that right away actually bring the ethnic disparity issue, because women of color have higher risk of having vitamin D deficiency, because we get our vitamin D deficiency from the sun working on our skin.
Yes.
And individuals with darker skin have a tougher time utilizing the ultraviolet rays from the sun. So vitamin D deficiency is very common in African American communities in general, men and women. So that could be the second hit. Another thing we and others have published on is increased BMI or obesity is also a risk factor for fibroid, and that could be the second hit. An interesting work done by other groups about the chronic stress as a risk factor for fibroid. And chronic stress could be actually caused by things like racism and discrimination. And some people feel that actually could be a contributing factor why fibroid is more common in women of color. There's definitely evidence that racism and discrimination can cause chronic stress, and chronic stress can cause inflammation. And we and others have published that inflammation is a risk factor for fibroid. So that could be the second hit as well. So using this two-hit model, you can start to kind of put these factors together, and that might start to present some explanation, at least partially, why fibroids are more common in women of color. But certainly we need a lot more work in this area.
I just want to add too that when we visited Dr. Alhendi's lab the other year, it was the number one post that we had for the entire year when he showed us the fibroid cells under the microscopes and the ECHO rats. So our community is really interested in being able to be their own advocate and take charge of their health. They were completely fascinated. In fact, I showed a picture of the cells No, I showed a picture of me looking through the microscope with Dr. Alhendy,
right.
And they wrote back and said, where are the cells? We want to see what you're looking at. How can you just post a picture of just the microscope? So we augmented that post, and the views were through the roof. So I just wanted to add that fact.
It's absolutely fascinating from a scientific perspective to think about the vitamin D deficiency in and of itself. That has been mentioned a lot with COVID, it's fascinating to think about how it affects also different ethnicities. Now here in Northeast Ohio, like Chicago, we don't get a lot of sun. So we struggle with vitamin D deficiencies, but that is so interesting to think about the absorption and how that might impact in the chemistry of a body forming fibers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would really encourage, I know this video is probably directed to healthcare providers, but hopefully they will convey the message to their patient. I definitely say this to all my patients.
Yes.
This also, beside being a good tool to understand the biology of the disease, it could be also a potential prevention tool. So I really would encourage them to test their patient with mild disease or early disease, or even patients who have higher risk of developing fibroid for vitamin D. And if there's vitamin D deficiency, to correct that. And we hope this can actually prevent or at least slow down the growth of fibroid lesions.
Yes. So Soteria, I wanted to go to and really, sort of hone in on, your founding of the Fibroid Foundation with the goal of patient advocacy and working with practitioners. Tell us about how far the foundation has come and how that philosophy has helped it.
Well, Angie, it's really mind-blowing. When I think about where I started, the power of a voice. Of one person's voice is just incredible. It still kind of takes me by surprise. But today we are a community of almost 30,000 people around the world. We're in close to 50 countries.
Wow.
And we have 26 chapters. 22 of those chapters are in the United States. And it's just really unbelievable to see the reach that has occurred, particularly because I do not have a medical background. I always wanted to be a doctor in my dreams and watching shows, but that is not at all what I majored in. So making that transition was even more shocking, if you will, to be able to have hopefully a positive impact and reach so many people around the world and help to inform people and help to transform lives. That's the most gratifying part of what I do, is speaking with people we've helped and hearing their personal stories and being able to meet them in person and realizing that some information that you provided completely transformed their day-to-day experience. It has brought many people to tears when they find the right solutions for their care. It brings us to tears as a team when we read the stories of people we've helped. We spent pretty much the whole week between Christmas and New Year's one year trying to help a woman in Kentucky who had been to three physicians trying to get a myomectomy, and several physicians, those three, told her no, hysterectomy. And she sent us the pictures, which we posted. The mass that they removed from her was larger than a football, full of fibroids. But she kept her uterus, and she's healthy now and definitely happy because she found the right treatment. And so we try to do everything that we can to support our community. And I really believe that, when you do something from the heart, when you try to help others, when you try to build on your own personal experiences to try to make a difference, that there's some really good things that come out of that. And we're looking forward to further dialoguing with our physician community. We're launching a new website in the week before Fibroid Awareness Month. So Fibroid Awareness Month is in July. Our new website will launch the last week of June. And we are in talks now for incorporating a physician portal to be able to interface more deeply with the clinicians that we want to reach out to, and that we hope will support our efforts and help to bring more awareness to treatments for fibroids.
Okay.